Hello, Radio Hour listeners. This is a quick message from your senior producer, Jerry Gorin. We are proud to announce the first ever live Radio Hour broadcast next Wednesday, December 9th, from the Arts Annex next to Skylight Books in Los Feliz. The whole gang is going to be there, and we've got a really, really fun show lined up with three awesome guests. Jeff Dyer, Terry McMillan, and Jonathan Gold are all on the menu. Again, that's Wednesday, December 9th, in the Arts Annex next to Skylight Books. For more information, click through to today's show page on our website or click on the info button on your podcasting application. And now enjoy the show.
Hello, Radioland, Podcastville, and all the ships at sea. My name is Seth Greenland, and you are listening to the LARB Radio Hour, brought to you by reader-supported Los Angeles Review of Books. Author Luc Sant is here to talk about his new book, The Other Paris. Have you ever heard of peer-to-peer microlending? Jessica Jackley stops by the studio to tell us about it, and we'll talk about her new book, Clay, Water, Brick. Did I get that title right, Lori?
You did.
I think you should try to borrow $20 from her. Many of you have written to ask us why BJ Novak keeps getting bumped. Well, we've had guests run long, he had a bad reaction to some green room canapes, and his monkey attacked an intern. He's had a run of bad luck, but today it's going to end. Stay tuned. BJ Novak is here. He will be on today's show. Joining me are my co-hosts. He's an author, a professor at UC Riverside, an award-winning beekeeper. One of those things is not true. LARB founding editor Tom Lutz. Hello, Tom.
Vitayu. That is, by the way, Belarusian.
How do you know Belarusian?
Well, it's our new Nobel laureate.
And her name is?
Svetlana Alexievich.
You pronounced that very well. Also with us, our other co-conspirator. She's written for the New York Times, the LA Times. She's written the graffiti on the ladies' room wall at Musso and Frank's, the one that says, "For a good time, call Joyce Carol Oates." One of those things is not true. She's the fiction editor of LARB, Lori Weiner.
Bonjour.
Luc Sant has written a number of books, including the excellent Low Life, which is a personal favorite of mine. He's the recipient of a Whiting Award, an award in literature from the American Academy of Arts and Letters, a Guggenheim Fellowship, and a Grammy, which I want to ask him about. His new book is called The Other Paris. Luc Sant, welcome to the LARB Radio Hour.
Hi, thanks. Glad to be here.
So let's sort out this Grammy thing first. What did you win a Grammy for?
You know, before the mic went on, we were all talking about the building I used to live in, 437 East 12th Street, where Allen Ginsberg lived. And for a while, he took in Harry Smith, the famous filmmaker, ethnomusicologist, magician, etc. And Harry came to my birthday party one year. And he was drunk, stoned, ate half the cake. And then he asked if anybody in the room could sing him a verse of Barbary Allen. He could tell them what county they were born in. And the only person in the room who knew the words was my girlfriend at the time. And he said, Bennington County, Vermont, and he nailed it. He was, wow. I mean, I could not believe, except, you know, it was an authentic feat of magic that occurred before my eyes. So when they were reissuing the anthology, I kind of knew Grill Marcus, and, you know, I told him the story, so he persuaded me to write it up, and I'm actually one of, like, seven recipients of this Grammy for those notes.
That's like Henry Higgins, you know, who would hear your accent and say,
right.
No, Hampshire.
Yes.
Yeah. And there's an app for it now. Yeah. That's how the world has changed.
Yeah.
Right. It was called Cunning Linguist, as I recall.
So the book is called The Other...
That's the heckling we were talking about,
yeah.
I think.
The book is called The Other Paris, the new one. And like Low Life, which is about the pimp's eye view of New York, this kind of takes the reader on a journey through the negative of what Americans typically think of as the Gene Kelly mm-hmm. kind of Paris. And I want to ask you, how is a city revealed through the pimp's eye view? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I don't really exactly think of it as the pimp's eye view. I think of it as poor people's view. And, you know, that's where I come from. Those are my roots. I'm from Belgium, but, you know, it's a shared culture in many, many ways. And it's, it was at one time at least two-thirds, if not three-quarters, of the story when you come to, and this is true of any city, really, but Paris is particularly fascinating because so much happened in popular culture down there that later got disseminated up higher, et cetera. You know, in this great churning mechanism of modernity, it's the part that got absorbed, trampled, spit out, evicted, expelled, et cetera.
And of course, a lot of the eyes that are on this poor people's eye view are not poor people's eyes themselves. That is, the flaneurs are not themselves poor people in most cases.
Generally speaking, that's the case. In the 19th century, partly because, let's face it, in the 19th century, most working class people were illiterate. This was true of my great-grandparents' generation and above. They all the documents are signed with X's. And so it's true during the 19th century that the most assiduous chroniclers are people who are deliberately déclassé in most cases. You know, take a figure like Alexandre Privat d'Anglemont, who was a black man. He was from Guadeloupe, but his mother had been very wealthy. Then their fortunes reversed and he was forced to make a living. And he lived very, very meagerly while chronicling every corner of the city. And then he died the poor people's death of tuberculosis at the age of 47. You start in the 20th century, you start getting in proletarian writers like the brothers Bonnef, who were members of a family of poor Jewish, I forget what they... carpet hookers or something like that. I don't know. Some trade they practiced in the provinces. And they were the great muckraking journalists of the decade before World War I. But that sort of thing came in slowly.
You said in an interview in the Paris Review that in the 80s you lived with a group of people who were direct action anarchists who actually made their living as thieves.
Right,
and
yes.
That they revealed to you the fundaments of the city that you wanted to learn about. And I'm curious how that process worked.
Well, I was there on this abortive magazine assignment about something completely unrelated and wound up staying with them for about 3 weeks. And, they taught me how to play poker in French. They taught me how to play billiards, which I played pool, but I didn't know billiards. And the billiard hall they took me to on Boulevard Edgar Quinet, this old woman wandered in and they called her over and they seemed to know her. And she was, in fact, a street prostitute, still working. And she at least claimed to have been quite intimate with Kiki de Montparnasse, you know, back in the 20s and 30s. And, stuff like this. And where they were living, too, was radically ungentrified as of yet. It was up by the Canal de l'Ourcq at the very top of the 20th. And it was really the inner Parisian equivalent of the Lower East Side at that time. And there was a lot of rubble and a lot of poor people. And... They loaded me up with lore of all sorts, gave me reading lists, and unsurprisingly, two of the four people I stayed with went on to start their own small publishing companies, which focus on, I use some of their books in the construction of my own.
And this was just for your own edification at that point? Just how can I learn about this aspect of Paris?
Yeah, totally. I was a kid. I was 20, 28 or something like that. And, I hadn't written a book yet. And I was just a sponge.
As a writer, I look at your book and I just think the subject of Paris, how would I write about Paris? And I want to lie down and take a nap. And I'm fascinated by how, as a writer of nonfiction, you apprehend a subject this large. And what was your process in terms of writing the book? Where did you begin? How do you begin with a subject this vast?
Well, you see, I'm kind of slow and stupid. And my first thought when they handed me this contract was thinking, oh, ha-ha, they want low-life Paris. And then I proceeded to forget about this for about 5 years and to fret myself to pieces, worrying how I could do a book about Paris that wasn't going to be like every other book about Paris. And then one day it hit me. Oh, right. Low life Paris. Bingo. And what I did simply was to accumulate a lot of documents. And I kept accumulating them as I went on, but I had this critical mass of books and magazines, et cetera, and then collaged the thing from there, basically.
But I wanted to ask you about the bad old days of New York, because you worked at the New York Review of Books. You started out as an assistant to Barbara Epstein.
Actually, I started in the mailroom.
In the mailroom, okay, even. and then you caught her eye, and then yeah. And you worked at the Strand bookstore also, right?
Yeah.
Probably before you went to the New York Review.
Yeah, it was my first job after college. And in between, I worked for a photographer who took author photos for book jackets. So all my jobs have been literary in one way or another. Mm.
But I just wondered if you could talk about those days a little bit. What was the New York Review of Books like, and what years were you there? And
I was at the New York Review from 1980 to 1984. And in those days, and you should, I mean, their offices now are deluxe, you know, but in those days it was chaos. Bob Silver's office had three assistants and gigantic mounds of books absolutely everywhere. It was like something out of Dickens. Barbara had a smaller office by herself, and I stood outside right in the middle of things, so it was visible to all. And the fact that I could only type with one finger was visible to all. and there were constantly the eminences coming in, you know, Isaiah Berlin, Jonathan Miller, a lot of people from England. And it was really run like some crazed combination of film studio and 19th century newspaper publisher. You know, all these stories, like the time the philosopher Stuart Hampshire left his shoes behind, and then we had to like keep expediting his shoes around the world, following him several cities behind, you know. It was chaotic. There were, you know, things thrown. There were almost physical fights breaking out sometimes on press day. Everybody's nerves were shredded. People worked into 3 o'clock in the morning. It was wonderful. And I learned, it was probably the biggest single component of my education. I had very good education. I studied with the Jesuits and I went to Columbia, but the New York Review is truly where I learned to think and to write.
And also, it was so exciting seeing those people come in, right, when you're that young. And
well, you know, actually, they weren't my people, those famous people. Mm-hmm. I was already reading the kind of stuff that goes into this book, and they were just too, like, British and academic and stuff like that for me. But nevertheless, I was aware. And, you know, you catch a kind of aura off certain people, you know. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God, that's Lincoln Kirstein. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know who he was, but I knew who he was just by his presence, you know.
Right, definitely, yeah. And the Strand bookstore is still in the same place, right?
Yeah.
And what do you ever, when you go in there, do you remember the old days and how it used to be?
Well, sure, of course. I mean, it was in those days, it was smaller. It was kind of brutal. The downstairs was 120 degrees, even in the middle of winter. It was a fantastic place to work in another way. I mean, well, I got a lot of books there, no question, especially since I was the one-man paperback department, and everything they'd get in that wasn't a hardcover book, they'd throw me. So I got all kinds of stuff. But also, it was the No Wave years, and everybody I knew was in a band, and bands were started on the shop floor at the Strand, and oh gosh, Lux Interior worked there for a week, and he took me to his house and was the first person to play me the Sex Pistols. You know, it was crackling. Electricity was in the air. Yeah.
All right, the book is The Other Paris. Luc Sahn, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you. It was great to be here.
My name is Seth Greenland. I'm here with Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner, and you are listening to the LARB Radio Hour, KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles. LA Times book critic David Ulan has been kind enough to return to the LARB studio to talk about some books he's been reading recently and has particularly enjoyed. David, welcome back.
Thank you, Seth.
The book you're going to talk to us about today is Richard Rayner's.
Richard Rayner's L.A. Without a Map.
L.A. Without a Map, which is one of his several L.A. novels.
He's written a number of books about Los Angeles. This was the book before I read this book before I ever moved here, certainly before I ever knew Richard. It's a book that came out in the 1980s. It's one of those novels that I really like where the main character and the author share a name, but it's a novel. It's a novel about a Brit named Richard Rayner who doesn't drive, much like the real Richard Rayner, who comes to Los Angeles and is kind of confounded by it, but in a really interesting way. And what I liked, or what first attracted me to the book was I spent a lot of time visiting here in the 1980s, and I thought his portrait of Los Angeles in the 1980s was extremely accurate at a kind of street level, in a street level way. The serendipity of it, the kind of odd lunacy of it, the disconnectedness of it, but the strange logic of it. Parts of the book end up taking place out in the desert, so that relationship of the city to the desert, or the urban landscape to the natural landscape. And at the heart of it, I think, you know, I love Rayner's writing. I love his persona on the page, and he does a really phenomenal job of kind of creating a version of himself, I think, as a character. It's not him, but it's the character carries his charm. It's kind of got that sort of, you know, stranger in a strange land quality, outsider adrift in a landscape that sort of makes sense, but not quite. That really echoes, and certainly echoed my experience the first few years I lived in Los Angeles, and he really captures it beautifully. And it's not a judgmental book. He, you know, he or the character is intrigued and likes it, but doesn't get it. And so I think it really captures all that quite well.
And like yourself, he's a great book critic.
He is a spectacularly good book critic. I'm one of the best readers I've ever met, and I believe mm-hmm. is the, you know, the person, I think he and I are vying for the heavyweight title for of people who have most books in storage in cities not Los Angeles.
So Silverblatt isn't on that list because his books are all in Los Angeles.
I believe his books are all in his house. Yeah. I would love to.
The
I would
apartment love, next door to his apartment.
Right. All right. I would love to marry the streams, but I think I would have to rent another apartment.
I thought you were
going to
say you wanted to marry Silverblatt.
No, so. I like Michael, but I don't. Oh,
you
know, yeah.
You heard it here first. This is how rumors get started.
Here we go. Now we're sliding down into the pit, into the abyss.
And what's Richard's other the LA novel that I first read before I moved here, which is Armed Response?
No, Murder. Murder Book.
Murder Book?
Murder Book, which is a noir, a detective novel that he wrote that I think is, one of the other things, he's had this fascinating career. He once described it to me as sort of the British model of career, where you do a little bit of journalism, you write a novel, you write a nonfiction book, you do some screenwriting, you sort of move around, which is actually a kind of, a very attractive attractive model for a writing career. But he wrote a book called Murder Book when did that come out? Like 96 or 97, which is a hard-boiled detective novel. He sort of gathered his influences, but to tell this story, and it's a really good Los Angeles novel as well.
Thanks, David. Jessica Jackley is an award-winning social entrepreneur focused on financial inclusion, the sharing economy, and social justice. But her major accomplishment, aside from carrying twins for 9 months, which completely blows my mind, I have no idea how anyone can do that, is the founding of Kiva, the world's first and largest person-to-person micro-lending site. She's got a new book out. It's called Clay, Water, Brick. Welcome, Jessica, to the LARB Radio Hour.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Jessica, what's micro-lending?
Well, we're going right into this, aren't we? And you don't want to talk about the twins' pregnancy? I was excited we were going to go there.
Yeah.
We'll get to that.
Okay.
We'll get to
all right. It's a fascinating journey.
I have no doubt.
Is that drool on your shoulder?
I know. It's actually, I already had to change my shirt twice today. I kid you not, from the third baby. But anyway, okay. Microlending. So think about, let's back up. Let's talk about microfinance for 30 seconds. So if you think about the products and services that you and you listeners access at your local bank, think about how those products and services might be tailored to the needs of somebody living on much, much less per day, you know, even a few dollars a day. So microlending, right? Microcredit is sort of one of these things under the broader umbrella of microfinance. And it's a small loan, a tiny loan, usually for business creation or growth, but sometimes microloans, sometimes these are used for other things too, housing loans, other kind of consumption loans. So
is there a history of microloans? I mean, was there what the first one was?
Well, it's funny because I think people have been helping each other out, you know, lending what they've needed, what their neighbors have needed, that sort of thing for a long time. And there are different forms that it can take. There are, under this heading of just microcredit, microlending, there are merry-go-rounds and basically, without getting too complicated, a lot over hundreds of years, right? People have gathered in groups and sort of traded and borrowed so that the whole group can sort of thrive. And maybe they take turns with a larger pool of money and they all access that. And as one repays, then the next person gets to go, that sort of thing. But sort of modern microfinance has been over the last 3 to 4 decades, depending on who you ask. And Dr. Muhammad Yunus has been a big player in that, founder of the Grameen Bank and the 2006 winner of the Nobel Peace Prize. But so has Exxon, so has Finca. They're sort of known for village banking. There are a lot of key players in this. But yes, over the last 3 to 4 decades is sort of, or 2 to 3 decades is how people look at it.
To paint a picture, can you give an example of a microloan in action? Somebody who applied for one, how much did they receive and what did they use it for?
Totally. So can I tell actually my, I shouldn't have favorites, but the person after whom I named the book. So he's one of my favorites. Patrick, this guy had fled the northern area of Uganda, had resettled in a small village on the border of Kenya and Uganda, and basically had to care for himself and his brother, was still a teenager when this had happened, and decided one day to sort of literally roll up his sleeves and get his hands dirty and start digging into the earth, found clay deposits, mixed those, clumps of clay with water, and then with his own bare hands sort of started to mold these bricks, sold them for fractions of a penny. After a while, was able to save up and buy a brick mold. Just picture like a rectangle divided in half. So he was able to make 2 bricks at a time. These bricks were more evenly and consistently shaped and sized, et cetera. And then he was able to continue to save and do better and better things. So when he received a small loan, just of a few hundred dollars, and this was after sort of where my story begins and ends with him, but years later, he did receive a small loan, as far as I understand it, and he was able to continue to build the business and thrive. Now, when I met him, the thing that he had received that I know for sure is a $100 infusion of capital.
Now, your organization is internet-based, so I'm picturing this, and I'm imagining Patrick doesn't have a Mac in his house.
Correct.
How does he get hip to Kiva, then? How does he find access to this kind of thing?
So you can like yell at me here and tell me to do something different, but I'm just going to back up and tell you other things as well. Before, just to set the stage here to answer your question. So think about
go back and we'll ask the question and then we'll cut it.
And
in.
Then
we'll,
you'll yeah, cut it, right? Yeah, you'll just yeah. cut everything I'm saying.
And then we'll yell at you anyway.
And they'll yell at me anyway. Perfection. So basically, there are thousands of microfinance lenders in the world. Now, some of these are strictly, microfinance institutions. Some of them are non-bank financial institutions. I won't bore you with all the structures, although I don't think they're that boring. Kind of interesting. But a lot are NGOs and nonprofits that also just have a lending component to what they do. So they exist in the world, with or without Kiva. Now, when Kiva came to be, and still today, these institutions can partner with Kiva to post profiles, a picture and a basic narrative about the person that they'd like to lend money to. They can post that on Kiva.org, and then Kiva helps, among other things, drive traffic to that website to allow individuals, any everyday people, right, with $25 or more to contribute to that loan need of the person posted there. So it's not so much that Patrick is on his Mac, right, or not on his Mac, looking for Kiva and trying to sign up. Traditionally, the way Kiva has worked, and there's an asterisk here, you can tell me if you'd like to go there or not, but traditionally, the way it's worked is that these lenders, these existing microfinance institutions that become field partners for Kiva, are out there finding the Patricks of the world, and more likely Patricias. That's another thread we can go on, we can talk about too. But they're finding these amazing individuals that are just ripe for a loan, allowing them to kind of get what they need. They're training them, they're administering loans, collecting repayments, et cetera, and handling all of that work on the ground. When they're working with Kiva, they're just posting that and accessing this amazing source of free, flexible debt capital from lenders.
Your agenda in founding this wasn't just to help the borrowers, though, because at one point, and I was really intrigued to read this, you turned down a gigantic amount of money. Somebody wanted to fund Kiva. I don't recall the figure. Would you say what the figure was?
Sure. So a few years in, 2 years in, Kiva had facilitated about $10 million in loans. And at the same time, we were on Oprah with President Clinton. It was this kind of crazy experience. As an aside, I hadn't owned a television in like a decade. So this is so old school. I literally remember going to a Blockbuster video, like a physical store, right? And walking in and finding a DVD of old Oprah shows. Cause I was like, I know this is a big deal, but what's this Oprah fuss about? Like, let me get my Oprah vibe on, right? Like I should watch some shows. Anyway. Uh-huh. So the week after that, we go back and like the phone's ringing off the hook in the office. And one of the phone calls was from a gentleman who wanted to, in his words, put $10 million into Kiva. And basically he did not want to do this in a way that supported the mission. The mission is to connect people through lending for poverty alleviation. It wasn't about and isn't about finding just buckets of money and dumping them into a system or even, investing or lending those funds, millions of dollars at a time, to a microfinance institution. Not a bad thing at all. There are a lot of other organizations doing that, though. And what Kiva was created to do was to connect people, right? To connect individuals to each other, human beings. And this gentleman, you know, again, Kiva was so early, so young, didn't have the capacity to really do any sort of tailored thing with this guy and the large corporation that he represented. We could just do the thing itself that we were just getting our sea legs about, just learning how to do. And it was allowing individual human beings with $25 or $50 to come to the website, browse profiles of entrepreneurs in need around the world, find somebody whose story resonated, lend that money, and then have this experience, right, of seeing another person's story unfold and then getting that money back at the end, ideally. You know, repayment rates hover around 99%, so that usually does happen. So we said no to that $10 million because it would have clogged up the system. I mean, if it took 2 years to get to that point, at that, you know, the pace we were going, it would have still been months and months and months at minimum that $10 million would have clogged up the system and not allowed individuals with their $25 and $50 at a time, $10 million worth of it, to come to the site and have that experience.
And therefore probably do it again.
Exactly. And again, like you mentioned the change, right? The change that happens not just on the other side, which is absolutely worthy and in and of itself important, right? What's happening in the life of a borrower. It's incredible. It's amazing. But the thing that is talked about less that I love and that I realize over time has been as much of a driver for me personally as anything else is seeing how perhaps a lender who has never thought too much about what's happening outside their own community or their own state or their own, you know, their country to say, oh, I now understand and I'm a little bit connected to this other person on the other side of the planet. And maybe, best case scenario here, in my utopian view of the world, maybe I think a little bit differently about poverty and potential. And maybe the sort of set of emotions that I have when I'm thinking about, for example, you know, a woman living in sub-Saharan Africa are not just the same old ones that are, for me at least, have, you know, in the past have been a reaction to stories told to me by well-intentioned nonprofits that are really focused on sadness and suffering.
Yeah,
and
I was just going to say it's a better system than Sally Struthers' mascara running down her face.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
God bless her, too. I mean, I remember those. I remember. She's in my presentation. I'm serious. I have a screenshot of that because I remember how I felt. I remember not knowing what to do. You don't want to turn the channel, but you kind of want to turn the channel. You feel awful. Mm. And that was the intention. But you feel bad enough to give, right?
And so you're saying we're going to make you feel good.
Good enough to give.
Yeah. Right.
Yes.
All right. The book is Clay, Water, Brick. The author is Jessica Jackley. I have one question before you go. Can I borrow $20?
Yes, you may.
0%?
All yes, right. Why not? Your trust, are you guys reputational?
I would
like
not.
I would not do
that.
Okay.
No, I don't.
You won't
vouch
for him. All right. We'll talk after.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Thanks to Luke Sant, Jessica Jackley. Thanks to David Yulin. Apologies to BJ Novak. Once again, we ran out of time, but he said he'll come back next week. Our thanks to our producer and moral conscience, Jerry Gorin, our crack production assistant, Ernesto Aureliano, czar of scheduling, Aviva de Kornfeld, and of course, the irreplaceable Sid Biggs. We couldn't do this show without the generosity of the Goldhirsch Foundation. Every week, we are grateful to them. Find us on the web at www.lareviewofbooks.org. Download us on iTunes. Better yet, give us a rating. 5 stars is very good. Write a review if you feel like it. Something that begins with, how do I love the LARB Radio Hour? Let me count the ways. You can fill out the rest. For Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner, this is Seth Greenland. Thanks for listening. See you next week.